This is what I've chosen to spend the next two evenings together. And I probably should begin with an explanation for why I'm talking about it. Because isn't this political? This is much, much, much more than political. But let me explain. Has anybody in the room had to take quote-unquote diversity training of any kind at work? Neil Shenvey is an apologist out there. He put together a chart. I think it was showing references to terminology from this philosophy that the New York Times was using. And he traced it, I don't know, starting about 2010, but once 2000 maybe, and then once you hit about 2012, 2013, the references to terminology like whiteness, white privilege, etc., skyrocketed. It's being taught in schools, it's being taught in the universities, it's pervading the culture. And number one, I think there's something to be said for understanding the times. Number two, it may surprise some of you to know that this doctrine, and it is a modern false doctrine, critical theory, and I'll explain to you why there's no race between those two words if you're wondering that. Critical theory, social justice, has made major inroads into the world of quote-unquote Christendom. Social justice is being made in other churches, not the Lord's church, but in the churches around us, a, quote, gospel issue. Those who don't join in the fight are being regarded as guilty of things like white supremacy and patriarchal oppression. Churches are being told that the church must join the social justice fight or it suffers from an incomplete gospel. If churches aren't using enough music and materials generated by minorities, they're promoting a truncated Christianity, quote unquote. In 2019, Southern Baptist Convention had its annual meeting. 47,000 churches are a part of the Southern Baptist Convention. Their messengers came, and as one of the things they did in 2019, Resolution 9, a formal statement affirming the value of critical race theory and intersectionality, was adopted by the Southern Baptist Convention. Now, you're thinking, what in the world is going on? Well, there was a whole bunch of rationale, but it's being blended with what the Bible teaches. Now, the language of the document was later repudiated, but for that to have even gotten to the floor and be passed tells you that there is a drive to make this part of following Jesus. Scripture is being twisted to support this ideology. Luke chapter 4, verses 18 and 19, Jesus comes into the synagogue at Nazareth as he was accustomed to doing, and they practiced mutual ministry in the synagogue in the first century. It's his turn. He gets up to read from the prophet Isaiah. Luke 4, 18 and 19 from the ESV reads, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Now, you and I hear those words and we think, okay, we know what this is about. This is Jesus proclaiming salvation from sin, oppression by sin, and things along those lines. But this passage, among others, is being used in the world of Christendom right now to support social justice. The argument is being made that, see, Jesus himself said that there's good news for the poor, slaves, liberation for the oppressed, and they apply all their definitions to those terms. Edit social justice out of the gospel, they say, and you have an incomplete gospel at best, or you are left with individualistic, white supremacist gospel at worst. David Platt in 2018, an influential evangelical speaker, delivered a message from Amos 5, and he read a whole, it mentions justice there, and he read a whole bunch of social justice issues into it and then repented in tears before the onlookers for his white privilege, his silence, and his inaction. By not adhering to the principles of this doctrine, he believed he had sinned against God, and he was teaching others to view their walk before Christ the same way. All variety of media right now are being created and promoted to spread this message. I kind of live under a rock to some degree, and I think some of us do, and that's not all bad. We don't live in isolation from the world, but to a certain degree, we have a measure of insulation. But for example, in June of 2020, Christianity Today, a publication founded in 1956 by Billy Graham, it serves quote-unquote Christian leaders in our time, they published an article entitled "The Anti-Racist Curriculum That White Evangelicals Need." They wrote, "Many white people in America have begun to ask, where do I start?" In other words, they're hearing these things and they're thinking, well, I need to get my mind around this. I need to be doing the right thing. Where do I begin? And so Christianity Today provided 10 books, quote-unquote Christian books, with titles like this: "I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness," "The Color of Compromise, The Truth About the American Church's Complicity in Racism." They listed multiple articles, movies, children's resources, which they said would be a good starting point for believers in Jesus to get their life in harmony with what God really wants. Vody Bachum, a name some of you may recognize, he said of all this, he says, if you find this odd, which some of us sitting here probably do, what in the world is going on? He says, if you find this odd, you probably haven't had a conversation with a Christian millennial recently. And he uses the word Christian more broadly than the Bible does. But therein lies one of the good reasons for us to talk about this. It's all over. It's affecting people we want to reach the gospel with. We're having to deal with it. Our children are having to deal with it. And you know the process that I do. What's out there has a way of finding its way in here in some form. And to some degree, perhaps it already has. The church and its youth particularly do not live, again, in isolation from the world. It's a rather remarkable thing, even what I've seen in my lifetime. I was in high school in the 90s. And in the 90s, the watchword was, you don't judge anybody. We took pride, well, the culture did, in its non-judgmentalism. But the culture has taken a huge U-turn. Our culture has become quite judgmental on certain things. It's been called the age of feeling, the age of authenticity, but someone else suggested maybe our age should be called the age of the gavel. You're not following this reality here. What critical theory, and I'm going to explain why I'm not saying critical race theory, what critical theory espouses, you're not following these tenets, then you are guilty of injustice and oppression. The secular world saying it, the proclaimed Christian world is saying it, and with them all speaking the same message, there's a real risk that some among us, particularly the uninformed and the unlearned or the unstable, may hear and believe. And after all, with the culture saying it and Christian literature, quote-unquote, saying it, there are other factors too. We want to be accepted. Is there anybody here who... some of us may be the type, well, I like not being accepted. But as a general rule, we're social creatures to varying degrees, I realize, varying degrees. But I think it's a natural inclination to want to be accepted. We want to be relevant. We don't want to be branded out of date, out of touch, or worse, racist, sexist, homophobic. So there's a temptation to join the crowd. This modern false doctrine, and that is what it is, again, I'm going to say has tremendous power. It has power to make you see the world differently. It has the power to make you see yourself differently. It has the power to make you feel differently about yourself. And it has the power, and is doing this all over, to make you feel responsible, if you're going to be a good person, to take action to right wrongs that you are not guilty of. And in fact, some wrongs that aren't even real at all. So my goal tonight and next week is to obey Paul's command, 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test all things. Is critical theory and the call for social justice something Christians should accept and adopt? And if not, why not? So to understand... to answer that question, we're going to have to understand what the doctrine teaches. And before we jump into that, I want to give just a very, very brief history lesson. I have written up here critical theory, not critical race theory. And the reason for that, and maybe everybody knows this, I don't know. But critical race theory is just one child in a large philosophical family that has been growing since the 1960s, though its roots stretch much farther back than that. In the 1960s, postmodernism came upon the scene. And I am no expert on postmodernism. Admittedly, have no desire to seek to be. The rise of postmodernism was associated with several French theorists. I won't bore you with their names. I'm not even sure I can correctly pronounce all their names. From those who do understand it, it can be difficult to summarize, but one of the basic tenets of postmodernism is one we're very familiar with by now, and that is that there is no absolute truth. Or at least we have no ability to test reality to know if what we believe is true, if in fact there is absolute truth. And as a result of this belief system that began to be promulgated in the 1960s, and by the way, it starts in those ivory towers of academia, but it doesn't stay there. This is something I think is very easily missed. I think it's going on all the time, has been for centuries, and people don't even realize it. But these ideas start there, and they make their way in varying degrees of speed into the culture. And I'll explain more about that here in just a moment. But as a result of this doctrine, the doctrine of postmodernism, the boundary between what is objectively true and what is subjectively experienced ceased to be accepted. After all, there's no way to objectively measure your truth against my truth. So the result, think about that. If you follow that to its logical conclusion, there are very few people on planet Earth who are willing to follow something like that to its logical conclusion. But if you follow that to its logical conclusion, that there may not even be any absolute truth, but even if there is, there's no way any of us can know it, what does that make of your life? Life becomes completely meaningless. Nothing I do, I have no way to know if anything that's ever happened mattered, if anything I'm doing matters, if anything I'm going to do matters. And what that did among those who took this to heart was it created a pervasive pessimism and cynicism and ultimately just despair. What's the point? So it didn't last long. The pure hardcore postmodernism couldn't last long. It burned out in the mid-1980s, and among people who care, they said, well, but I still believe there's a lot of truth here in this postmodernism. So what they did is they found a way to take what was really inapplicable to the real world, and they said, I want to hold on to some of this, but let's find a way to apply it to the world. Let's make it actionable. Let's find a way to do something with it. And so from the ashes of this, in the mid-1980s, late 80s, early 90s, new theorists arose who took the tenets of postmodernism and they generated new theories. Post-colonial theory, queer theory, and critical race theory. It's been around for quite a long time. Postmodernism, which had really just been completely out of touch with the real world and meant nothing to people, suddenly became moral. Now you say, well, how does something that denies absolute truth become moral? In order for something to be moral, you have to have certain things which are true, right? So what they did is they said, well, there are some things that are true. We can't know what's true in most areas, but there are some things that are true. Well, how do you come to that? Again, we're not following the Bible, so how does a mind reason to that point? Well, here's how they reasoned. They said, you know, Rene Descartes over there, or it was analogous to this. Rene Descartes, he's the one who said, I think, therefore I am. So I'm thinking, I'm having thoughts. That is proof to me then that I really do exist. They did something similar. They began to coalesce around this idea. Look, there is suffering in the world. There's suffering in the world. And if there's suffering, that means there's something to suffer. So there's oppression, there's suffering, therefore we are. And if there's suffering, there must be something causing the suffering. Therefore, there is something that is oppressing. I experience oppression, therefore I am, and so are dominance and oppression. And once they accepted that oppression was something real, and of course it's bad, then you need to right that wrong. Enter social justice. One of the things that makes these theories stand out among academic theories is that they openly, from the very beginning, have taken an activist position. These philosophies have been getting taught for some time, and They are openly and avowedly activist. We are not just about deconstructing the world like the armchair philosophers, modernists. We are about understanding the world and then going out to change the bad parts of it. They're teaching, this is what is taught. This is a part of an academic study. So among the members of this philosophical family, as I call it, we have the ones I've already mentioned, post-colonial theory, queer theory, critical race theory, but added to that are gender studies, disability studies, and they call them, this title's been around since the 70s perhaps, fat studies. I would not use that term, but that's what they call it. And all of these are built on certain premises that we're going to take a look at here in just a moment. They all share certain ideas, and I have put them all under this category of critical theory. There are some who agree with that decision, some who disagree with that decision. I've heard some say, well, it should be contemporary critical theory, but whatever. These are a group of theories that all fall under this general ideology. So what I want to do is I want to go through some of the basic tenets of critical theory so we understand what they're saying. And then once we've done that, I want to look at a few characteristics of critical theory, because there are a few things apart from its ideology I think we should know about it in social justice. And then after that, we're going to look at where it agrees with the Bible, where it doesn't, and finally, what the Christian response to it should be. So I just gave you the remainder of tonight and next week, Lord willing. So what are the tenets of critical theory? Number one, and I don't intend to do much of this, but just bear with me. I'll go ahead and use their terminology. There is what's called the social binary. Bi, of course, means two. What's that all about? I am not here to be political, but I am going to go ahead and quote a political document because it's related to this. In 1848, Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. And the first two sentences of the Communist Manifesto, I'm omitting some of the second sentence, but here's how it reads. He begins, "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. In a word, oppressor and oppressed." Karl Marx believed, wrongly, I will add, that all the history of the world was really just an elaboration on this reality. There are classes and they are at odds with each other. Critical theory is derived in part from Karl Marx's conflict theory. And to the critical theorist, the whole world is one big power play. If you want to see some of these books, I will be glad to share them with you. I'm certainly not recommending them as reading material. I am very glad I've spent time trying to get my mind around some of this, but I admit I'll be glad not to think about it, at least not as much as I have been, but I'm very glad to have done so. It's been good for me. But Özlem Sensoy and Robin DiAngelo is the one who wrote White Privilege. In their book, Is Everyone Really Equal? An Introduction to Key Concepts in Social Justice Education. This is one of the most influential college textbooks right now being used to train future educators in this country. Here is what they say. The societal default is oppression. There are no spaces free from it. They are saying every aspect of your life and human existence is typified by oppression. They go on to say, this is... I won't bother you with a page number, but if you'd like it, I'll be glad to give it to you. They write, "Thus, the question becomes, how is it manifesting here? Rather than, is it manifesting here? There's no question that there's oppression in every aspect of life. The only question is, how is it being manifested?" Now you think, okay, well, when you've got a binary, oppressor and oppressed, there has to be kind of a line of demarcation. When you've got two armies at battle, there's a front line. There's a line where they're meeting. So where's the line of demarcation between oppressor and oppressed? Well, it falls along the lines of identity groups. Race, class, age, gender, quote-unquote, which they make distinct from sex, which it is not. Ability, parent-child. Everybody falls on one side of that line of demarcation. And there's this thing called intersectionality. We've heard of that, maybe, some of us? Very simple concept. I was glad to find this one simple. You've got all these different identity groups, and you've got all these supposedly oppressed identity groups. Women are oppressed. Minorities are oppressed. Homosexuals are oppressed. Non-Christians are oppressed. These are all these different oppressed groups. Well, some people are members of more than one oppressed group. And so they exist at the intersection of those things. And so what that does is it creates layers of oppression. A woman in America supposedly experiences oppression to one degree, but if she is, for example, what did I write down here? A minority homosexual Buddhist woman, she's got four layers of oppression. Now, these power dynamics, you might say, okay, I hear all this stuff, but you may or may not feel like you see it. And that's a very interesting part of this theory. These power dynamics are invisible, or at least not readily seen, to those who have not been awakened to them. Those who have not yet become woke. You have to be, if you are among the oppressors, you have to be awakened to them through education. Thomas Sowell is a genius. If you don't know who Thomas Sowell is and you like to read it all, even if you don't like to read, you need to get a book by Thomas Sowell. It's the only book I'll recommend apart from the Bible tonight. It's called Discrimination and Disparities. Thomas Sowell is a black man, grew up in Harlem. He's just a genius, I think. And he makes this very interesting observation. And whether you agree or disagree, I still thought it was a very interesting observation. And I bring this up because I think it reveals that this kind of idea about invisible oppression has been around quite a long time before CRT and the term woke ever came into our cultural vocabulary. He writes the following. There is a whole genre of words and phrases like glass ceiling, implicit bias, covert racism, which proclaim that statistical disparities show biased treatment. And he says this conclusion must be believed without visible corroborating evidence, which is why you have words like glass, implicit, and covert. I thought that was a very interesting observation. What those terms are admitting is these things are not obvious, but it's argued that they're there if you're given the right perspective. Now, this oppressor-oppressed dynamic, this social binary, brings us to another related tenet of critical theory. Critical theory interprets the world in terms of groups. I'm John, but in critical theory, it's far more important, it's of first importance, that I am a white, heterosexual, cisgendered, able-bodied Protestant male. Those things are what is of first importance because those facts alone have the power to determine whether I am guilty or not of oppression. Listen to what one woman by the name of Peggy McIntosh in her document, White Privilege and Male Privilege, listen to what she wrote. My schooling gave me no training in seeing myself as an oppressor. I was taught, wrongly, to see myself as an individual whose moral state depended on her individual moral will. You hear that? This doctrine makes you accountable for things that you have not done. You are guilty. What does God say? The soul that sins shall die. We shall each appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive the things done in our bodies. This is not where this doctrine takes people. This doctrine also teaches that knowledge and we can probably use the word truth here, although they use the word knowledge more often, that these things are socially constructed. I'll explain that in a moment. I believe that there's such a thing as absolute truth. And if it's true, it's true for everybody. According to this teaching, each culture constructs or produces its own truth and its own knowledge. And so if you're working within that particular culture, as long as you operate according to their set of rules, and notice, by the way, the connection between knowledge and power. If you operate according to their knowledge, their truth, that is, their set of rules, everything will go great for you. But remember, critical theory says there's no absolute truth, with the exception of oppression and all that. So what is true while what's true while you're operating within one culture does not remain true when you step into another culture. Theory insists that no one set of cultural norms can be said to be better than any other. So how far do they take this? One writes this: the idea of objectivity in Western intellectual traditions is problematic for many reasons. And to think that there are universal truths perpetuates a particular kind of able-bodied, white, cisgender male logic. Does that mean anything to you? That's the sort of thing you got to read about five times. What they're saying is simply this: the idea that there is absolute, undeniable truth in the intellectual world, this is an idea that came from or is promoted by white, straight men. This is their truth for their culture, their identity group. Social justice scholarship argues, Judith Katz in her diversity curriculum, which is used by some of the biggest companies in the world, and bear with me, I know I've been reading a lot of quotes, and I know we're getting close to the end of our time, but I really want you to hear this thing. Here is how far they take this. This is a diversity curriculum used by some of the biggest companies in the world. She teaches objective, rational, linear thinking. In other words, A plus B equals C, things like this. Controlled emotions, the scientific method, quantitative research. These are all defining marks of white culture. She also includes individual has primary responsibility. Working hard brings success. Planning for the future. Delayed gratification. The valuing of continual improvement and progress. Written tradition. Nuclear family is the ideal unit. Belief in Christianity. These are components of white culture. So, each culture, each identity group produces its own knowledge, according to critical theory, and that knowledge is true, quote-unquote, for it. It's not true for others. And that knowledge, that truth it produces, the way it produces it. There are different ways of producing knowledge. This is called other ways of knowing. What's this about? Critical theory says knowledge can be gained in a number of ways. Listen to what a professor who teaches this said. We must learn to trust our own senses, our feelings, and experiences, and to give them authority. Social justice scholarship argues that reason and evidence-based knowledge are unfairly favored over tradition, folklore, interpretation, and emotion. And I could give you an example of how far they're willing to take this. There's a thing called research justice. Okay? If we're going to write academic papers and we're going to cite all kinds of research, if you just cite research that comes from that white, male, cisgendered approach to things, that's not being just. So you need to cite other kinds of research, quote, other forms of research. What would those be? Superstition. People are dead serious about this. These are academic papers, and we're going to cite other forms of research so that we're being just. Superstition, spiritual beliefs, and they're not talking Christianity. Cultural traditions, identity-based experiences, emotional responses. These are legitimate other ways of knowing on par with facts, as I see it. And one of the important ways of knowing that gets talked about a lot in discussions of oppression, as it's getting so much attention right now, is lived experience. Some of you in some of your training may have encountered that term. This is very simple. Lived experience means if I believed I experienced it, then what I believe is true. If I believe I experienced it, it is true. And it's built on two assumptions: that everybody in a particular oppressed group has the same general experience, assuming they understand their experiences correctly. We'll talk about that next week, Lord willing. They have all the same general experiences, and assuming they understand them correctly, they will interpret them the same. And number two, your position within that social dynamic, whether you are oppressor or oppressed, will determine how much what you can and cannot know through lived experience. What do I mean by that? All lived experiences are not equal. If I am in the oppressor group, my lived experience isn't worth much because my privilege blinds me from reality, from seeing things. If I'm in the oppressed group, I automatically understand the oppressor because I deal with them all the time. But as an oppressed, I have a lived experience that they can't relate to, that they are blind to. So I have double sight. It's like a Gnosticism. I've got special knowledge. James Cone, father of black liberation theology, said this in this vein: whites are incapable of making any valid judgments about human existence. This is a man who claimed to be a Christian, and this is what he said about his quote-unquote white fellow Christians. They can't make value judgments about it. Reality. Why? Because they're a part of the oppressor group. Finally, this is one of these weird words, hegemony. Hegemon is a Greek word which means ruler. This is the word used for Pilate. In Matthew 27, 2, he was a ruler. And this has to do with ruling. It was borrowed from an Italian philosopher. What it boils down to is this. Karl Marx predicted that there would be this worker-led revolution, but it never happened. It never happened. So Antonio Gramsci, who was a Marxist of sorts, he was looking at all this and he goes, all right, why didn't the revolution happen like Marx said it would? Ah, I know. Marx was only focused on economics. There was something else at work. The workers would have revolted if not for cultural hegemony. What's cultural hegemony? Well, the ruling group, they have control of the schools, the churches, the courts, the media, the family, and all these other things, and they promote their ideology through all those things, and so the lower class just ended up being conditioned to follow the rule of the upper class, and so they didn't revolt because they had been basically brainwashed and conditioned. I'm almost done. I do want to mention a couple other things before I close. In the critical social justice view, Christianity is a part of the oppressive cultural hegemony. From a book I have at home called Critical Race Theory, An Introduction, this statement is made. History books, Sunday sermons, and even case law contribute to a cultural hegemony. Two more quotes and I'll sit down. The significance of Christianity, this is written by a critical theorist, the significance of Christianity in U.S. life and the challenges it poses for minority religions, did you hear that? The challenge it poses for minority religions is a social issue that requires the kind of historical knowledge and structural cultural analysis we use to understand other forms of oppression that stand in the way of social justice. That's the only quote I'm going to read. But did you hear what he just said? He said Christianity is an oppressor that stands in the way of social justice.